I feel super nervous.
It's all right.
Okay.
Like, right. Pretend we're in the pub.
We are in the pub.
Well, I'm gonna
add like some pub ambience.
Oh, cool. Nice.
It's gonna be like clinking glasses.
Could be a fight.
Yes. There may yet be a fight. Hi, welcome to Why Are Computers, a podcast that attempts to answer that question by talking to people who reckon stuff about computers and hoping they accidentally say the answer. I'm Tom Stewart. This is episode 1, the shambolic pilot episode. If we get picked up for a full series, then I'll be recast and my parts of this episode will be redubbed by someone with a mellifluous voice and appealing personality. I'm joined today by James Coughlin. Hi, James.
Hi, Tom.
Who are you?
I'm James. I do Ruby and JavaScript stuff. I work on an open source project called Fay, among other things. I sort of poodle about London with a laptop.
Right. Doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
Going into pubs. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you today is that, like most programmers, I think, you are occasionally angry about things. Specifically angry about, like, the state of software, how bad most software is, and probably like most programmers, you think you can do better than most of the bad software that's out there. But what's unusual about you, it seems to me, is that unlike most programmers, you actually do something about it, in that when you get sufficiently annoyed about something, you will actually spend the time to write some more software, some new software, that's notionally an improvement on the software that currently exists.
It's called not helping.
Right, well, possibly, but it strikes me as quite a positive anger management strategy. You can kind of channel your frustration into the medium of software rather than the medium of, like, tweets and blog posts, right?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes that leads me down a incredibly silly alleyways where it turns out I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Right.
But one of the nice side effects of ranting about stuff on the internet is that occasionally people who know more than you come along and correct you and explain why you have no idea what you're talking about, and then you learn things. So that's quite nice.
Right. I was thinking the other day about what we could speak about, and I was thinking about capybara, and this is probably one of my favorite Ruby libraries for anyone who isn't already familiar with it. Capybara is like a browser automation library for Ruby. It gives you like a nice Ruby DSL for controlling a web browser effectively. You can say, go to this URL and click on this link and fill in this form and press this button, and it will, and it has a kind of pluggable driver architecture that allows you to implement that DSL against something that looks like a web browser, and that might be, so there's like a rack test driver for it that just pretends to be a web browser, just talking the rack interface directly to your rack application if it's written in Ruby, or there's like a mechanized driver that actually makes HTTP requests, and there's an HTML unit driver, and all the way up to Poltergeist, which is a driver for PhantomJS, and then Selenium, and things that can drive real web browsers like Firefox and Chrome and stuff like that. And you wrote a capybara driver called Terminus, right?
Yes.
I wanted to kind of pick at that a little bit. Firstly, what is Terminus and why is Terminus? This is like a restriction of the Why Are Computers question, is what is Terminus? And then secondly, like, can you tell me a bit of the story about like all of the other software that this project generated? Because it seemed kind of amazing to me.
Yeah, ended up being quite silly. So about 2009. I had one of my sort of frustration-triggered silly ideas, which is that I wanted to be able to test web apps that had JavaScript on them.
Right.
Which was still, like, at that time, there weren't an awful lot of really good ideas about how to do that. The whole JavaScript unit testing thing was sort of in its infancy a little bit. There were tools for doing that, but they weren't as sort of widely used as they are today. So I had this kind of silly notion that it'd be really great if it was as easy to test web pages with JavaScript on them as it is to test those without. Because,
right.
The way you've just described Capybara and the tool that preceded it in Ruby called WebRat, because web pages are nice and machine readable, you can just have a client sort of interact with your website as a black box and script it and write tests that way, and it's really cool. But JavaScript's a bit more tricky, and in particular, before really PhantomJS came along, all your options for doing JavaScript testing really involved like fake browsers.
Right.
So you had env.js for Rhino. There was HTML Unit, which is a Java fake browser, and all these things are basically software libraries that give you an interface that's like a web browser but don't have a GUI. They just behave like a web browser but don't draw anything on the screen. So you can still script them and interact with them and check things. They just don't paint anything. So that means you can use them from the command line and put them in a continuous integration process and all that kind of thing. But the thing about web browsers is that they're all really different and they all have bugs. So fake browsers are not really, at least in my experience, all that useful because they've tended to be a bad approximation of the real thing.
So even in the unlikely situation that your fake browser is actually a 100% faithful representation of the underlying specifications, it's still not necessarily going to tell you, give you very much confidence that it's gonna that your web app is going to work right in Firefox or whatever.
Oh, well, sure, right. So... To sort of cut a longer story short, if you're using a fake browser, you're really just testing on one more browser target that
right.
is not like the other browser targets. And, I got frustrated with trying various of those. I always found it really easy to find fairly show-stopping bugs in them, like things that do work in browsers that just totally crash the test system. So that was kind of annoying, and... what I really wanted to be able to do is have so if you're doing unit testing in JavaScript, you just have a web page with some script on it, and you load it into a browser, and you can see if the tests pass. And you can do that in any browser because it's just a web page, and you load it somewhere and have a look at it. But you couldn't really do that for full stack stuff very easily because you either had to you had to be using that Selenium would support, or you'd be using one of these fake drivers, which wouldn't tell you really anything useful about your cross-platform support. So what I wanted to do was make it so that it was really easy to test full-stack stuff on any target browser, any device, anywhere, on mobile phones, remote machines, anything like that, and without needing any plugins. So you wouldn't have to get Selenium hooked into your phone somehow. You could just... point your phone at some web page and it would let you control the phone and navigate around your website. So that's sort of what Terminus was. I'm not sure if it was a Capybara driver originally because I'm not quite sure how the timing of that played out, but at some point early in its life it became obvious that it should be a Capybara driver so that you can use the same Capybara testing API, just swap the back end out on all your tests can still run against this other thing.
Right.
And that's really nice. Capybara is a really nice system that I wouldn't say it's easy to do a back end for it, but the contract between Capybara and its back ends is quite cleanly separated. It's quite a like sensible API contract between Capybara and its driver plugins. So it's sort of easy to understand what you need to do.
Right.
Doesn't imply that actually doing that backend is easy, but the architecture is fairly sensible.
So fundamentally, what you were going for here, just to make sure I understand it correctly, is that effectively what you ended up doing with Terminus, or at least trying to do, was to kind of implement a whereas all of the implementations of existing drivers will be to do with either having a fake browser, or in the case of something like Selenium, it's using sort of browser specific extension APIs to sort of you have to install a plugin or something inside the browser to get it to be remote controllable. Your idea with Terminus, I think, was to say, could we do all of this just with JavaScript? Could we kind of build you know, do all of the stuff to do with changing the location of the browser and clicking on links and all of that stuff just kind of in browser with JavaScript, and then presumably, I don't know at what point you knew how you were going to do this, but have some kind of two-way channel of communication from the browser back to, like, the terminus process, so that when you're running your acceptance test locally, your in-process acceptance test stuff can, like, speak to the JavaScript that's in the browser and get it to click on the links and fill in the forms and stuff, right?
Exactly, yeah. So it's more sort of controlling the browser from inside the web page rather than controlling it from outside with a plugin or some kind of other harness system.
Right. Well, that seems like a really, like, a super useful idea, and I'm glad you did that. However, I gather that you had at least two problems, and it's the two problems that I know about are, number one, you wanted to have that bidirectional communication with the server. And problem number two was that I think the Capybara, the driver integration API that you just mentioned, is done in terms of XPath, right?
Yeah.
And so when you use the Capybara DSL and you say, I want to click on a link or I want to press a button, ultimately the information about what link and what button to click on or press is communicated by sending strings of XPath up to the client. Is that
right?
Yeah,
exactly.
So why were those two things problems, and what did you do about it? What terrible thing!
Well, the fact that we're now talking about this and it's 4 years later gives some indication of the scope creep involved.
You're still working on all of the software that fell out of this, right?
Yeah, most of it, yeah.
Right.
God.
It seems like a totally plausible thing to do.
Yeah, it's this sort of... It's a fairly deep yak shave. Capybara lets you, in its front-end API, it lets you pick elements out of the page to interact with CSS or XPath.
Right.
But if you use CSS, it converts it into XPath so that the contract with the driver is simpler. There's only one language that the driver has to understand.
Right.
And also XPath can do things that CSS can't. So if you're going to compile one to the other, CSS to XPath is the one that makes sense, because CSS, if you compile XPath to CSS, there are some XPath things that you won't be able to convert in that way.
Right.
So, yeah, the first thing is Capybara will give your driver XPath, and you have to deal with that, which is fine, because most browsers have a function called document.evaluate, which is, it's sort of clunky, but what it does is it runs XPath queries against the page, and then gives you an iterator that gives you all the nodes that match the thing. The other thing was, like you say, your test program, which is written in Ruby, needs to be able to tell the browser to do stuff. So you have to send commands to the browser and then find out what happened. So you can tell the browser to do stuff, and you can ask the browser things like, how many elements match this selector, what's the current URL, all that sort of thing. You need bidirectional communication. The second of those things, the communication problem, is basically why I started Fay. And at the time, we didn't have WebSocket yet. That was still sort of on the horizon. And I was looking around about, okay, how do you do this? And I'd heard about this thing called Comet, which is a sort of umbrella term for a bunch of hacks that people use to do two-way communication for browsers. And so I looked into that, and then I found out about this sort of open protocol for doing that called BIO, which there's a bunch of implementations for, but there wasn't a Ruby one. What I really should have done is used one of the existing ones for Java or whatever and written a Ruby client for that.
That would have made a lot of sense.
It would have made a lot of sense. And my life would be quite different now if I'd done that.
That was probably bad software, though. If you looked at the Java clients, it was probably unacceptable.
No, it's pretty good. So I thought, okay, I'll do a Ruby implementation of this BIO protocol.
Right.
And so I did a server and a Ruby server and a JavaScript client for it, and that meant that basically what that protocol gives you is it gives you pub sub semantic messaging between web clients. So it means that you have a central hub, and then clients can connect to that, and they can exchange messages via pub sub.
And this was all sitting on, at the time, this was sitting on top of like long polling and like with like various exactly. strategies for kind of for faking out bidirectional communication over HTTP, right?
Yeah. So pre-WebSockets, you did stuff like the client would send a request, and then the server would just not respond to it for ages until it got a message.
Right.
And then it would send the response with that message in it, and then when the client got that, it would just immediately open another request.
But the intention being that this that buyer kind of abstracts away the details of the underlying transport, and that in principle you might be able to replace that transport with, you know, if your browser suddenly had an API that allowed you to just open a TCP socket, then you would still be able to sit buyer on top of that, right?
Exactly. So like buyer has like it's within the scope of buyer that it defines a transport negotiation system where the client can say what it can do, and the server says what it can do, and somehow they agree on what type of network transport to use. So yeah, that meant that when WebSockets came along, they could be sort of transparently integrated into that. So yeah, it totally hides the network, all the messiness of browser networking from you, which is quite nice. So yeah, so I sort of looked at that and started hacking a server for it, and sort of used that for a Music Hack Day project to put iTunes in your browser. That was sort of fun. It would let you play songs, and then they'd be it would make them play at the same time on other people's machines, so you could have a sort of listening party thing.
Right.
So that was quite neat. But that then I sort of it was a sort of just a little just good enough implementation, and then I sort of put it away for 6 months. And this was still, I haven't even started working on Terminus at this point. This is still just like, what do I even need? What technology do I need to even make that possible?
And this is still pre-WebSockets, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So this is sort of mid to late 2009.
Okay.
In 2010, this is when like Node started getting off the ground. It's like Node.1. Still like quite early and very early and a little unstable, but like it was usable. And so one weekend I thought I'll try this out, and I'll port this Faye thing to it, which I hadn't really announced or released at anything. It was because it was, you know, not really production quality software.
Right.
So yeah, I ported the server from Ruby to Node to sort of learn what this Node thing was all about. And in Ruby, I'd been using Event Machine to do this. So it's a very similar architecture in Node. It's all sort of asynchronous network stuff. And so that was a fairly easy translation. And then once I'd done the sort of Node version, I sort of started. Like it started looking like a real project, just because of the sort of, you know, you revisit a project and change stuff and improve it and update it to make it work with whatever's current now. And yeah, it started sort of looking like a real thing, or I started thinking of it as just not just a weekend Music Hack Day thing. I was like, oh, this is a thing now.
Right.
So yeah, then over the sort of first half of 2010, that was sort of a lot of the most of the early work that turned it into a project. Like, went through several release cycles, put a website up for it, said, like, I announced it and said, hey, there's this thing I'm working on, and it started getting users.
And at this point you still haven't actually written Terminus.
No.
Right.
but it like it did let me start working on Terminus.
Right.
So, yeah, by sort of late 2010, I had an early version of Terminus that could do the stuff I wanted, that spoke to Capybara, and yeah, would drive most of the sort of standard Z browsers, and would do a little bit of iPhone at a push.
Right.
And so it was showing a little bit of promise. But it's still nowhere near a sort of Terminus is still nowhere near being any sort of a reasonable product. It was like a demo at this point. So yeah, that takes you to like year the first 18 months
right
of this ridiculous project.
It sounds like in principle you could be close to being finished here. You've got a demo working. Surely just polish it up and round the edges off, and you've got yourself a product.
Yeah, just ship it.
Yeah,
put a squirrel in a hat, and it's yeah. done. Yeah. So web browsers. The other fun thing about web browsers. Is that one of them is really not very good. So, actually two of them in this particular instance aren't very good. So, Internet Explorer and the Android browser don't have this document.evaluate function that does XPath for you. I was like, oh, that's kind of a deal breaker, because that's the big thing that's a problem for cross-browser testing. The thing is like most that you most want to target doesn't have this feature that Capybara needs in order to work. So I spent ages looking around, and there are various sort of XPath-y things that do, like if you've got a document fragment from an XHR request, you can do XPath on that. You can do, if you're doing XHTML, you can do XPath on some bits of that, sort of. But there was no like direct what people later started calling polyfills.
Right.
There wasn't a polyfill for document.evaluate. I couldn't find anything that was even close enough that would just let you go query the page. It was like either query a document fragment or query an XHR response, or you know, they just didn't implement all of XPath, or they were just buggy or whatever it was.
Right.
And I really tried to find something, because I really didn't want to write an XPath engine. For fairly obvious reasons.
It would probably turn into a massive yak shave.
Right. But no, I ran out of steam on that search. So, okay, well, if this is going to work at all, it needs to have an XPath thing. So I just had to bite the bullet and write one, of course. But... So XPath is, if you haven't used it much, it's sort of similar to CSS selectors in what it does. It lets you query an HTML or XML document using a selector language, and it has a slightly different syntax from CSS, and it also has some features that aren't in CSS. It's got various functions in it that, in particular, lets you query the text of things and their attributes in ways that CSS doesn't let you do. The really neat thing about it is that XPath expressions can be sort of nested inside each other. So you can say, like, select all the divs that contain anything matching this other selector. So it's sort of recursive in a way that CSS selectors aren't. That means that parsing it is kind of hairy, and I really didn't have any experience of writing parsers at this point, and it sort of looked really intimidating to try and parse this actually fairly complex language by handwriting code. I just knew I'd make loads of mistakes, and it would take forever to get right. What I had done is that I'd previously used this Ruby library called TreeTop for doing... I'd sort of played around with doing some sort of Lisp clone stuff in Ruby a while ago. So I played around a bit with TreeTop. I knew that you could use something like TreeTop to parse something like XPath. So TreeTop is a Ruby thing where it lets you write a sort of declarative grammar for a language, and it generates parser code for it. There is a library for JavaScript that does the same thing. It's called PegJS.
Great.
Yeah, job done. Except I'm a total idiot. And I'm very, very fussy. And, seriously, PegJS is really good. I had some very, very minor quibbles about its syntax and about exactly how it generated stuff, which are really, really minor quibbles. Like, this is not even a criticism. It's just me being a pedant.
Right.
And I was also just sort of curious about how this stuff worked. It's like, because I'd played around with doing Lisp interpreters before, I thought, like, oh, there's sort of the next stage down of that, of like, oh, how do you do parsers? So I'd been interested in language implementation for a while, and this seemed like a good opportunity to learn some more about that. So yeah, I thought, well, how hard can it be? I'll just write a parser generator myself to do this XParse thing. And yeah, that was sort of scary, but not as difficult as I'd first thought. I sort of bootstrapped it by inventing this sort of JSON format for doing the grammar, so I didn't have to parse a new syntax language.
Right.
So yeah, invented some JSON representation for saying how the language worked, and then turned that into what are called parser combinators, which are just functions. Like, you can make a function that matches a string, or a function that matches something one or more times, or like all the sort of things that you see in regexes. All those concepts can be turned into functions that just do that thing, and then you can compose them, and those are called parser combinators. So I wrote a fairly simple thing to turn this this JSON format into combinators, but it's really, really slow, because making all these functions and calling them has quite a high overhead in JavaScript. It's the easiest way to do it, because you don't have to do code generation, really. So it's not like doing a full-on parser generator, but it's not very performant. In particular, like, you're sending code over a long polling thing to Internet Explorer 6, and then asking it to parse this query and then execute it against the DOM. There's already loads of stuff that's going to be very slow. So, yeah, the performance of this thing was just unacceptable.
Right.
So, yeah, I decided I needed to do, like, the next thing and make it faster, which meant I had to do code generation, which is sort of, once you've done the combinator stuff, you can sort of see how you would generate code to do the same thing. I had some help. I just went and looked at the code that TreeTop and PegJS generate to see, like, what sort of thing they're doing. Like, oh, it turns every rule into a method. Okay, and it turns a one or more selector into, like, a while loop with a counter. And you can sort of see what's going on. The code that these things generate is very verbose. But if you just play around with writing a grammar and changing it and seeing how that changes the compiled output, you can kind of get a feel for how it works. So, yeah, so I sort of went through that process up to the point where it was powerful enough that I could write a new, instead of doing the sort of JSON format for the grammar, I could do an actual grammar syntax format, and then compile that into code that parses the same format. So it became like self-hosting.
Right.
So yeah, somewhere in that project there is a file that describes its own syntax, which still sort of does my head in quite a lot. And once you've bootstrapped it, working on it becomes really complicated, because you have to use the previous version of the thing to compile the next version of the thing. And then if you get it wrong, you then have no working files anymore.
Right.
So that's kind of fun. So yeah, all that sort of ended up being a project called Canopy, which I released as open source. It's sort of, I think it's probably just me that uses it, but it's kind of a fun learning experience. One of those things that I didn't do because I thought loads of people needed it. I just did it because I wanted to learn how to do it and how to test it and all that sort of thing.
Right.
But that was a pretty big diversion. That sort of took, I was working on that on and off between 2010 and 2012, just sort of coming back to it. You know, it was originally a Rhino script, and then I turned it into a Node thing.
And this is just getting you to the point where you can parse an XPath expression, right?
Yeah.
You still had to deal with the problem of actually, like, evaluating XPath.
Right.
Did that turn out to be straightforward in comparison to parsing the expressions in the first place?
Less work.
Right.
I don't really know how XPath worked at the time, but, like, it's not very complicated to understand. It's got some, if all you know is CSS, it's got some slightly funky semantics, because it can do, like, parent selection and has this concept called axes, which are sort of strategies for walking the DOM. Like, you can say, like, an axis expresses something like, select all the children that match this, or include the current node in this, or include all the descendants in this. So you have this combination of tag matches and attribute matches and axes and functions, and it's all a bit weird.
Did you therefore eventually reach a point in time where, is it called pathology, the XPath implementation?
Yeah.
Did you reach a point where that was actually an acceptable implementation of XPath 1 that had enough XPath support for the Capybara driver API?
It was sort of, it was just enough to make Capybara work, as in I just did it by running the Capybara test suite.
Right.
And adding stuff until it all passed.
So it's still,
it's really not complete, and it's quite slow.
Okay.
And it's by no means a complete XPath implementation. It was just a sort of, just enough to support the things that people are probably going to use Capybara for.
Right.
That was a kind of weird project in that, like, when I put it on GitHub, I just started the GitHub project, and I put the name on it, which is pathology, and I think the description just said, the goggles, they do nothing. And it got followers.
Wow.
There's no code. It didn't say anything that it did. It was just, like, aroused enough curiosity that that people started watching it, which is very, very strange.
Wow. So, at this point in the story, does Terminus exist yet?
Yeah, so now it sort of is increasingly a real thing, because it will run... you can run it on Internet Explorer, and it can just about do Android browser stuff.
Right.
There was still ongoing stuff, like Capybara was still evolving.
Yeah.
So I'd sort of periodically do maintenance work to make it keep working, and, you know, browsers keep changing. And there's a lot of stuff in Terminus that is just quite egregious hacks around, like, browser differences and all the weird sorts of things that Capybara can do to web pages, including stuff like... So Capybara isn't just for testing Ruby stuff. You can point it at any web application and it will work. You can just say, go and talk to this host name.
Right.
And you can point it at Facebook or Gmail or whatever.
Yeah. Assuming you've got a driver that can make HTTP requests, right?
Right. So the thing about Terminus is that it needs to inject this JavaScript thing into whatever page you want to control, because it's sort of controlling the page from the inside. So what that meant is that the way that it loads pages is it runs everything through a proxy, so it can inject this JavaScript into the page. But it also has to do stuff like, in order to make sure that every page gets loaded through a proxy, it has to rewrite all of the links in every page to go through localhost.
Right.
And it has to rewrite... Like, there's a bunch of rewriting, and then there's a bunch of rewriting back in the opposite direction so that Capybara gets the sort of real URL back out when it does stuff. That's all egregious. There's like stuff where it doesn't really deal with chunked encoding very nicely, so you have to strip those headers out in the request phase so that you get non-chunked encoding text out and everything gets easier.
Right.
There's just piles and piles of messy nonsense to make it work.
But it did work.
It did eventually work. So it's, I think, sort of at some point in 2012, like, a website for Terminus went up with a little bit of documentation.
Right.
And a few people started using it.
And then WebSockets happened.
Right. Well, like, WebSockets had happened sort of a while ago. That started in 2010. We started getting WebSockets in browsers. Some point during, sort of within a year of me starting work on Faye, then WebSockets came along and sort of changed everything. And because this was still really early days and there, like, weren't really any good libraries for it, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to implement this WebSocket protocol thingy. At the start, that was pretty easy, because the handshake format was really, you didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to do any of the crypto stuff that they added later. It was just like, you'd get these headers that told you it was a WebSocket, and you'd send these other headers that said, yep, okay, I can do that. And then there was this really... simple message framing format where it would send you a null byte and then a bunch of text and then a 255 byte, and that those delimited the message, and you would just run through everything you received over TCP and parse that.
That sounds brilliant and simple, but this was an evolving standard, right?
Right. And then, so someone decided that they needed binary support. So previously, this was like, it's UTF-8 text delimited by a 0 and a 255 byte. And there was a couple of versions of that that actually got deployed in browsers that differed a little bit on their how the initial headers were done, but that wasn't really a big problem. And then sometime 2011, we started getting the thing that would eventually become the RFC thing that was way more complicated, and it had UTF-8 and binary messages and control frames like ping pong, explicit closing. The handshake was more complicated. You had like masking. So there's this thing WebSocket does where all the frames that are sent from the client, in order to stop browser-based JavaScript programs for being able to send arbitrary crafted byte sequences to web servers, everything that gets sent from the client has random noise applied to it.
Right.
So a WebSocket frame is these four random bytes. There's some headers and then four random bytes that tell you what the noise mask is, and then there's the rest of the message, and you have to XOR those bytes off of the message to parse it. So there was... it's one of those things where I really didn't know what I was getting into with doing this project, because like, oh, I'll just do this messaging thing for browsers. Oh, that seems to work. And then people are like, it should really use WebSocket because that's a better solution to this. I'm like, yeah, well, it is. Okay, I'll do that. And then people keep, you know, putting out new versions of this WebSocket thing.
Yeah.
And you never knew when they were coming along exactly, or when they'd show up in browsers. So I just had to sort of keep up with it. So sort of 2011 had several sort of panic weeks where a new version of Chrome came out and now Faye didn't work anymore.
Right.
Which that was sort of one of the biggest like externalities of doing this project, of like I was sort of unwittingly committing myself to maintaining this thing that I had no idea how it was going to evolve. I didn't even know that it would exist when I started the project. It was just like, okay, you want to do this, we're going to do it this way now. That's how the web is going to work now. You've got to deal with it.
What was your goal at this point? Were you trying to support only the latest version of the WebSocket standard, or were you trying to support, I don't know what the negotiation is like, but are you able to support like all possible standards? Are they distinguishable?
They are distinguishable. At some point during the thing that led up to the RFC, they put in an explicit version header.
Okay.
But even before they did that, you could tell based on other properties of the headers which one you were dealing with.
Did you end up with one of these horrendous grids of like all
of
the different...
It's not so much
versions?
A grid. Like really, like nowadays, or the, like in terms of stuff that actually got put into browsers, like there are things that tracked every little draft of the RFC that came out. But in terms of what actually got put into browsers, you really only had to support three things. There was the original, what's called Draft 75, that went into Chrome. There was Draft 76, which was like that, but with a different handshake. And then there was a series of things that led up to the RFC that by the time they actually got put into browsers were sort of mostly stable-ish. By the time that stuff went into browsers, it had stopped radically changing the framing format.
Right.
So it's not so much a grid as just there are sort of basically three backends to this, and you can support all of them on the same server, and
okay. Faye
still does. Draft 75 really doesn't get used anymore. Draft 76 is still, if anyone's still running Safari 5, or actually PhantomJS, I think, is still running this. It's still around a little bit, but most stuff is on the RFC now.
And just to emphasize how much effort this involved... I'm just reminding myself that you were doing this for an implementation that was written in JavaScript that runs on Node, and also for an implementation that's written in Ruby that runs in Event Machine, right?
Yeah.
Did you keep those two things like in perfect sync? Like every time you went and updated the WebSocket implementation, you were doing it twice.
Yeah. Basically, this is another way I didn't realize how much work I was making for myself. It was just because of it was originally a Ruby project. And I needed to do Ruby stuff with it, but I also ported it to Node, and people were using that.
Right.
It was sort of, yeah, I've got to maintain both things now. I get very guilty about not maintaining stuff, and there's a lot of stuff that I've done that is really badly maintained. It's just that Faye has the most sort of users and attention and people relying on it. So it's what gets my attention.
Right. And then am I right that latterly you broke out? So at least initially this stuff was all just baked into Faye, right? But then you...
Yeah.
As far as I understand it, so Faye has its own, like, GitHub user, right? You have...
Yeah.
This has produced enough software that you have, like, a Faye user, github.com/Faye, and then right. There are a whole bunch of repositories there. And the WebSocket stuff is broken out into, like, a Faye WebSocket library in Ruby and Node versions.
Yeah.
And then those depend on a WebSocket driver library in both Ruby and Node versions. I mean, I gather that the WebSocket driver stuff is just a implementation of the, you know, the wire protocol.
Yeah, exactly.
Without anything on top of it. And then I guess the Faye WebSocket stuff is the interface between...
It's actually with the fact that it's called Faye WebSocket tends to trick a lot of people, because what it really means is it means it's a WebSocket library that was extracted from Faye.
Oh, all right, okay.
It is just... So there's... Yeah, it was a sort of sequence of extracting things. First, the... It was inside of Faye. It was always done in a pretty modular way, but yeah, the first bit of extraction was that I broke out this thing called Faye WebSocket, which was just this thing for doing WebSocket handling for Rack and for Node.
So if I wanted to write a Rack app that had WebSocket support, I'd use Faye WebSocket to do that.
Exactly, and that was based on, that made certain assumptions about how you're doing I/O. So on Ruby, it assumed you wanted to do I/O with Event Machine,
right.
And you were using an Event Machine-based web server, which over time became more and more problematic because, Thin's been very popular for a long time. It started getting sort of supplanted a little bit by stuff like Puma, which isn't based on Event Machine.
Yeah.
And, so the thing that triggered the sort of second phase was that the guys that maintain Puma and another project called Celluloid, which is an actor-based concurrency and I/O framework, asked if they could take the protocol handling stuff out of Faye WebSocket and not take the Event Machine-based I/O system. That was the sort of second bit of extraction, of just taking all the protocol logic and making it so that you could have a thing and you could attach it to any I/O system you wanted, and then you'd have a WebSocket and you didn't have to worry about how the protocol worked or anything like that. So
that's what WebSocket driver does.
Exactly.
Right.
And then Faye WebSocket is really just a thing that glues that to Event Machine.
Right.
It's become very, very small.
And then Faye itself sits on top of that and deals with all the buyer level stuff.
Yeah, so then Faye, like, it uses that and it uses Event Source and it uses long polling and it implements the buyer protocol and all of that stuff. So... Faye WebSocket is just one of the transport components that makes that up.
Right. So this is quite a lot. We've talked about quite a lot of software here. So you kind of... I tried to, before we spoke today, I was sitting down, I was trying to create a sort of a partial map of, like, the Coglinverse of, like, all of these pieces of software and how they related to each other. So, yeah, so you kind of... It seems like Terminus is where you started. Terminus kind of triggered the creation of Pathology, which triggered the creation of Canopy.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was just along the axis of XPath.
Right.
And then separately, you kind of... Terminus triggered the creation of Faye, and then the subsequent kind of arrival of WebSockets ended up writing all of this code, which meant that you ended up with the Faye WebSocket stuff, which sits on top of the WebSocket driver stuff.
Yeah.
So there's sort of quite a large collection of... is there anything I've missed out? I mean, I know there are a bunch of other peripheral things like the Redis integration and the cluster stuff, but I don't know whether you use those in Anger or whether they're on the critical path to just getting Terminus working in the way that...
The Redis stuff wasn't. That was... the thing that makes Faye a bit weird is that the reason I was writing it was to do sort of weird stuff with web browsers and... weird music projects rather than doing large-scale messaging things. So when people came along and said, we want to do large-scale messaging things, but you've given us this single process Ruby messaging hub, we need something better, then that's where the Redis stuff came in. It's sort of making the back-end sort of business logic-y bit of Faye pluggable so that you could, you know, run a whole cluster of Faye servers and distribute a load.
Right.
And that's been quite fun because it's let, like, making that bit pluggable has meant that other people can write plugins. So MySpace did their own sharded Redis backend that solved a bunch of problems that they were having, and they open sourced that. And it's really nice to be able to take a bit of a system and figure out the abstraction boundary well enough so you can just defer that problem to other people.
Right.
So because I'm not the one who's doing these big, large-scale messaging deployments of it, it's really good to be able to offload solving that to people who are doing it and really know what the problems are, and then they can share that back with the community.
Right. So at the end of this whole... I know that this process is ongoing, but at least having got to the point where all of these pieces of software were implemented and working to your satisfaction, how much use are you getting out of Terminus these days, like, having got it working?
Not very much. This is the sort of weird thing, is that I thought Terminus would be really useful, and really it's only a handful of people that care about it. There's orders of magnitude more people found Fay useful than right. found Terminus useful, which I really didn't expect, because it started out being this really sort of hacky thing that didn't work very well. I'm surprised that it became usable enough that people started, you know, using it in their companies and things.
Right.
That was a big surprise.
Well, that's really interesting to me that you kind of semi-accidentally have kind of mined this very rich vein of utility for people.
Right.
That, like, just by going through this exercise of having some potentially, you know, Terminus was not necessarily something that you had, like, a burning need for, but you just felt like you wanted to make either for fun or for, like, a small amount of use.
Yeah.
But just by kind of pulling on that thread, you've kind of all of the rest of this stuff has come out, and you've kind of, just by following your own needs, you've kind of uncovered this right. really rich area. And yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people who use Fay. I use Fay, as you know. Like, it seems like a really popular... from the outside, it seems like it's the most used thing that you've made. Is that...
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
It's certainly... If I'm at a conference or whatever, that's what I introduce myself as working on, because it's what people tend to have heard of.
Right. And, I mean, I don't want to get too much into any more of this stuff. That's a fascinating story, and I would love to hear more of the stories, but I think there are other stories that have a similar kind of character, right? Like, in my mind, you are characterised by this desire to... By a lack of hesitation in going out and just making your own thing, right? So you've got, like, you've got JS Test.
Right.
And you've got, like, I guess JS Class and JS Build are kind of tied into that, and you've got... Wake for doing the kind of makey stuff. Like, those all form like a cluster in my mental model of the right. Coglan verse, right? I don't 100% understand.
Do you have a map of this? Because I'm kind of terrified.
There does need to be. And then there's a separate constellation, which is like your Scheme implementations or your right. Lisp, your Lisp implementations, right? So you had like Cargo in JavaScript and Heist in Ruby, is that?
Yeah.
And then various other bits. I remember you talking about Primer, your caching thing for Rails app.
Yeah,
Active Record.
That was a terrible idea.
you subsequently completely disowned that idea, but at the time, you know, it seemed cool.
That was totally one of those things where I was just naive enough to think it was a good idea and went and talked about it.
Yeah.
And then learned a bit more and discovered it was a terrible idea. But, you know, that's doing that sort of stuff is educational.
Right. And you've been talking, not recently actually, but in the last year, you were talking about Coping, the templating language that you were playing around with.
Yeah, that was sort of a like conference day
okay.
hack
right.
thing. That's still sort of an experiment that I show to people occasionally and ask if it's any use.
Right. So I think this is sort of more generally something that I was interested in asking you about, is just this the way that it seems that you do a lot of your thinking like in public and on GitHub.
Right.
And like when you look at the list of your repositories on GitHub, there's kind of a power law of like, you know, there's Fay or not that, well, they're not even on your repository, but you know, there's
yeah.
of the stuff you're responsible for on GitHub, there's Fay and all of its attendant projects, and then there's the stuff under Jay Coglan on GitHub, and there are a few like big ticket items in there, and then there's this really long tail of just like stuff that's like, you know, they've got two commits in
right.
and like no readme, and there's like, you know, like a bot that does a thing or something. There's just like lots and lots of stuff there, and it gives me the impression at least that you're someone who, when you start thinking about something, your mechanism for doing that may well involve like hacking on some software to do it.
Yeah.
And then your MO for hacking on that software is that you're just going to put it in public. You know, I don't know to what extent you get excited about coming up with a good name for it and making sure you've got like the gem name or the NPM name or whatever it is. Like,
I actually banned myself from naming projects at Songkick because I'm so bad at it.
But like, to what extent? it sounds as though this is an integral part of your process for like for figuring stuff out, right? Like, so the thing with Primer, which very briefly was involved, you were trying to solve the hard problem of cache invalidation, right?
Yeah.
Given that you're abdicating responsibility for the hard problem of naming, you thought you would focus on the focus right. on the cache invalidation. And yeah, I remember when you were speaking about it, because you were doing like runtime instrumentation of Active Record instances to like try and figure out when they had changed and
right.
And it was an intriguing idea. And it's the kind of thing that, like, if I'd had that idea down the pub, I would have, like, nodded to myself for a minute, and then I probably would have not gone anywhere with it. But you have, you know, you at least worked through it to the extent that you built a piece of software, and then you went and spoke about it in public. And, yeah. like, it seems like it was maybe through, you maybe required that whole process of doing all of that work to even figure out whether or not you liked it or not.
Yeah, sort of. Like, looking back, that's the sort of problem that should really have been done. That's one of the very small set of problems for which the right answer is do a new language.
Right.
Because, yeah, it was this really sort of hacky thing where it would try and infer and record how your templates depended on your data so that when your data changed, it could invalidate your caches. And it was really bad, and the way that it did that involved storing a huge amount of metadata that was just completely ridiculous. And if you want to do it properly, you would have to build a system that had that baked in, which various other people have done. It sort of probably has more in common with, if you look at the sort of data binding in JavaScript frameworks these days, the sort of the notion that your view automatically updates when the data changes. I was trying to do that, but for a sort of server-side Rails thing,
right?
Which is, it doesn't really work as well there just because of the volume of storage you need to do.
So I've kind of hypothesized an answer to the question already, but I wanted to ask you explicitly, like, why do you do this? Like, why do you? This isn't an intervention. It's just like, why do you live your life in this way? Like, is this so the kind of stuff that you did for? And you've partially answered this question in what you said about the various stuff that spun off from Terminus. But like, do you feel like the production of all this software is done primarily out of actual necessity, or is it primarily out of curiosity? I mean, it sounds like, for example, the reason why you wrote Canopy was primarily because you were interested. If you had not been interested, you probably just would have used PegJS, right?
Yeah, it was a kind of necessity in terms of I wanted to use it in order to do something else rather than just doing it for its own sake. Plus, I wouldn't say frustrated, just having some different design ideas than the existing tools that were available. Like, for example, like one thing that's in there is that a lot of parser generator things, they let you put code in line in the grammar,
right,
for saying how the different modes should behave. I've always disliked that. I have always kept the codes, the grammar in one file and the code in another file, and had some syntax for how you link them. Partly because I've just always found that easier to maintain, but also it's sort of, I've had an idea on the back burner, like doing it that way means that I could actually quite easily write some other backends for Canopy that generated other languages. So right now it only generates JavaScript, but you could quite easily make it generate Python or Ruby or Java. Or,
right. Because there's no programming language in line with the...
Exactly.
I remember the first time I saw Treetop, I saw the syntax for Treetop, I was confused about that. Because right. as someone who was interested in parsing already, when I saw the inline Ruby code inside the grammar, my first thought was, how does the parser for this grammar language work? Because yeah. I think in Treetop, when you want to introduce a piece of I can't remember what they call them, semantic actions or whatever, yeah, inside the grammar, you have, say, an opening curly brace, and then you have like some Ruby, and then a closing curly brace. And the immediate question that occurred to me was, how do you know when you reach the closing curly brace? Because the Ruby's going to have curly braces in it, yeah, and some of them are going to be inside string literals, and like, how do you know? And the answer in Treetop is, it just counts how many opening and closing curly braces it sees. It doesn't know about Ruby.
Right, but it at least needs to know enough about Ruby that Ruby's use of curly braces requires balancing.
Right.
Which means that if you've got that assumption, you can just say, yeah, let's just count balanced braces. That's fine.
But if your Ruby code is set, if your Ruby code is just puts a literal string with a closing curly brace in it, then
it won't
you're screwed. Yeah.
I don't know, maybe you can escape it, or maybe it does something like, you know, in Make you have to do the $2 signs because you don't want, like, no, this isn't a Make dollar sign, this is a Bash dollar sign.
Right. But this obviously annoyed you sufficiently that you felt... So maybe my choice of...
It wasn't so much annoyed as being like, I have this other idea and I feel like I might just about understand enough to be able to have a go at doing it.
So that pretty much falls under curiosity, right?
Yeah.
It's like you... It's not so... I made a joke at the beginning about you just being angry and channeling your anger into open source, but I think it feels like it's slightly more virtuous than that, in that, like, you're actually just interested in how things might be done, and when you can see something like that where an opportunity has gone unexploited, you're kind of interested to see how that might work out.
Yeah.
Regardless of how much of your life it might consume in the process.
Yeah, I wouldn't say regardless. I'm like a bit, I'm much more cautious certainly about announcing and releasing stuff these days because of, you know, now I know what actually being a maintainer means in terms of time.
Right.
I can't take on a lot more of those commitments.
So that reminds me of, as you were talking about Faye, for example, it felt like there was a point where... So all of these things, as evidenced by your GitHub account, it seems like these things start life as like something for you. Like you're hacking on something locally, you quite quickly decide you're going to push it up to GitHub just so you've got like an offsite backup or whatever, like for whatever reason, so you can give it a cool name. And then it's up on GitHub. But then at some point, some of your projects kind of go through this phase transition where they stop being something primarily for you and you start thinking them as being something for other people.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things I think is very impressive about the projects where you've made that transition, is that you're very conscientious about like making sure that your stuff is well documented. And there are some other things that we should also talk about, other properties that your software has, but primarily in terms of like presenting it to the world, making sure you're not just slapping in a half-finished README on the GitHub repo. You're like, you have a nice subdomain on jcoglan.com and you go to the trouble of like designing a nice set of pages and you write narrative documentation and stuff. And like, I wonder, what is it that makes things, how do you know when something has sort of tipped over into that state where you're like, oh God, time for a new subdomain?
I think some of it comes down to, well, there's a bunch of reasons why it could happen. Either I've have some indication that it's something other people want.
Because people are already using it, or
no, it's a thing where you see people being frustrated by a certain thing, and you think you might have the answer to it.
Right.
Which most of the time you don't, but that's fine. I think there's sort of another angle to it, which this sort of templating stuff that you brought up earlier. I've got this sort of experimental project called Coping, which is like a type-safe templating library. So, for example, if you've got an HTML template and you've got a thing that drops a value into an HTML attribute, the templating library knows how that should be encoded when you drop it in. So in Rails, when you drop stuff into a template, it automatically gets HTML encoded. This system can do more context-aware encoding of stuff. So it will, if you're dropping something into a query string, it will CGI encode it. If it's into HTML, it will HTML encode it. And it will even do that in different places in the same template. It will know, it understands the sort of grammatical structure of what you're doing, and it knows how things should be composed together. That sort of project is more sort of, I don't know, I guess, like argument by programming thing, where you're sort of going, well, we've got this big problem, which is that encoding stuff is hard and security is hard, and doing all that stuff correctly is really, really hard to explain. You know, you see like code bases that have, someone's written a URL, a URL builder that has ampersand AMP semicolon in it, but doesn't CGI encode the stuff that's being dropped into the parameters.
Right.
Because people sort of view source on web pages and you can't see the layers of language involved in how that works, and so you don't know what to attribute different symbols to. So it's sort of trying to make a thing that makes it easy to do the right thing even if you don't fully understand what the problem is. It's sort of going, okay, there's this problem with web development. I haven't seen any good solutions to it. Here's an idea. Is it any good? That's sort of not so much going, here is packaged finished stuff. It's going like, what if you could do this? And here's a demo.
So as of right now, coping hasn't made that transition from a thing that you made for your own satisfaction to something that other people are using.
It's not on Ruby gems. It's not been, like, there's no packaging. It's sort of minimally documented. As in, the README is like, you can do that. It's not, here's everything you can do with this. It's like, here's one example of a thing you can do with it.
Right. And what would need to happen for it to make that magic transition to get, like, coping.jcoglan.com?
I think people would, like, have to show enough interest in it. It's sort of, I've shown it to a few people who are into sort of formal languages and security and stuff, and had some, I've used it to have interesting conversations about that stuff. Like, when I've shown it to some people, they've said, oh, it shouldn't really be a templating language. It should actually be a thing that treats all these things as data structures and encourages people to treat things like HTML documents and URLs and SQL queries and JavaScript as data structures.
Right.
And there's a point there, but it's also like, how do you make this stuff, like, how do you package a good idea in a way that makes it so easy that people will want to use it over what they are? You know, ERB has, you know, spoiled people with convenience about, like, you just drop a string in here, that's great.
Yeah.
If you want to do something, like, if you're trying to put forward another alternative, you know, you're fighting a usability competition with ERB, which ERB is really easy to use, but very hard to use correctly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can do a system and go, hey, let's all become Haskell programmers and learn how to compose stuff properly.
Right.
Or you can try and sort of meet people where they are and go, here's this thing that looks mostly like what you're doing, but it's better.
Right.
And so it's that, like, trying to trade off, like, correctness versus what should the right interface be that makes people feel comfortable using it.
Yeah. That leads me into another thing I wanted to ask you about, which was sort of, I suppose, generally about your attitudes as a maintainer of open source software. I mean, in my mind, I characterize you as a relatively conservative maintainer, in as much as you seem to say no a lot more than you say yes to things. And even when you are saying yes to things, it's after quite a lot of not pain necessarily, but, like, you're certainly not, you know, you're not one of these people who just wants to shovel as much stuff as possible into your software. And maybe that's related to to the idea you just explained about sort of software as argument. Like, if you see the pieces of software that you make as being, you know, I guess primarily as software and people can use it to get stuff done, but, like, the reason why you have constructed it is as an expression of an idea that you have, it seems to make sense that you're not necessarily going to want other people's, or even your own, whims to kind of pollute the clarity of... And, I mean, quite a lot of the time I've seen you say to people, like, well, that's a great idea, like, you should do that, you know, as a plugin or as a different piece of software or something, just because it doesn't align exactly with what you're trying to do with whatever the piece of software is. And I'm also aware that you have opinions on things like API stability and API design and just generally that. It reminds me, I wrote down that you did some tweets a few months ago, which I found sufficiently interesting that I wrote them down. You said, web software is built by the smart and young, and its pace of change privileges the mentally agile. This includes both consumer software and dev tools. Change spends people's time. Like, that sounds like something that quite a conservative maintainer would say. How do you handle, like, you obviously the stuff that you've worked on has changed over time.
Yeah.
And you are still, as far as I can tell, actively maintaining a lot of this stuff, certainly Faye. How do you manage that process, and, like, how does your own attitude towards your own software kind of shape, you know, how something like Faye changes over time?
Well, it's mostly influenced by what I find painful using other stuff. Yeah, I think when you describe me as conservative, the sort of core of that is that I really value stability. There's that article about the sort of like the worse is better school of design versus the it must be correct school of design. I'm sort of more on the latter end of that spectrum. Like, to me, like, it's like, I will put up with any amount of complexity in the implementation to make sure that the interface is right. And yeah, that mostly comes from being frustrated by, you know, having spent, like 7 years now doing Ruby and sort of living in the Ruby ecosystem for that much time, like none of the software that I use looks anything like it did when I started using it. And there are good reasons for that, and there are bad reasons for that. And the thing that sort of most concerns me is like when like stuff that gets changed because someone thought that that's like the new way is how it should have been done in the first place, and it's obviously better, but it doesn't really give it doesn't give anyone any real new capabilities or power. It doesn't really fix any mistakes, and it breaks their existing software. So, right. To me, the sort of canonical example of that is the Ruby 1.9 hash syntax. Which a lot of people are like, oh, it's obviously better. But it doesn't let you write programs that you couldn't write before.
Right.
It doesn't fix any mistakes that anyone was making before. And it means that if someone uses that syntax, that program now won't run on an older thing. It's kind of, it's purely an aesthetic change, which the aesthetics of code are important. And it's important to have stuff that's readable. But if you have a thing that's already been shipped, like making those tiny little sort of fussy aesthetic changes to it, to me never seems really worth it. If you're going to change something, you'd better be giving me a lot more power or preventing me making significant mistakes. Because when you change stuff, you're spending, or to put it the other way, when I change stuff, as a maintainer, when you change stuff, you're spending people's time. When you break people's software, you're spending their time, and you don't know what kind of context that might be in. You know, if you are, you don't know how costly people's time is, and a lot of cases, it's a lot more costly than you realize. I mean, just in terms of companies have to pay people to do this stuff.
Right.
You know, people get locked into, huge like legacy problems where they can't upgrade things, and now they've got like massive technical debt that you know slows entire companies down. Like keeping software in a state where people can upgrade it easily without having to spend a lot of their own time, to me is really valuable. And if you make software such that people can't do that easily, I don't think you're helping them. You're going, okay, I made this tool and you've adopted it and you've got utility out of it and now you're sort of dependent on it. Now I'm going to make that dependency very costly for you.
Right.
Versus probably not explaining this very well, but if it's unstable, you've then got someone has a bunch of code that's coupled to that, and now that code is really costly and it's a liability.
Right.
And I really don't like doing that to people.
You don't want that to be your fault.
Well, I don't like it when people do that to me. Right. So, like, therefore, I try not to do it to other people.
It reminds me more generally of the problem of the kind of instinctive tendency of developers to prioritize the concerns of developers. Like, I mean, I think that
right.
I think your Ruby hash syntax example is a great example of that. Like, you're more concerned as the author of some library or as the creator of Ruby or whatever it is, whether rightly or wrongly in that specific case, but in general,
yeah.
This idea of saying there's something that I as a developer am concerned about, whether it's aesthetics or the names of things in my API or whether or not I'm using the new hotness or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to make that my focus and like not necessarily concentrating on when you do this cool or hot or new thing, like what the knock-on effect is going to be on the people, whether they're other developers or like regular people who are using your software.
Mm.
And that seems to be relatively endemic. Like a lot of the things that I see you complaining about in the world generally are sort of instances of that problem, right?
They're kind of... I think I just see... I don't mean to sort of write this argument off entirely because it is kind of valid, but I tend to discount very heavily any argument that's based on what makes programmers happy. It's not that I like using tools that I like using.
Right.
I like stuff that makes it easy for me to do my job. But an argument about making developers happy can never win over an argument about keeping users happy. So stuff like, I'm going to build this thing with some JavaScript front-end framework that doesn't work without JavaScript. That's an argument that makes the programmer happy, but doesn't consider, you know, a certain class of users who are not going to be able to use your stuff. It's the same sort of wasting people's time thing. If you make there's a lot of websites that use JavaScript that I can never get into load on a mobile phone because it's too slow.
Right.
And you could be sitting, I don't know, you're like, I don't know, you're seeing your lawyer or something, and you can't get you need some bit of information. It's taking forever. Like, that amount of time that it's taking for you to get that information is costing the user. Like, I know that's sort of a really niche problem, but like, people's time is costly.
Yes.
And making stuff that is either inaccessible or very lengthy to get hold of when you had plenty of options to make that not the case, I don't find that acceptable. There's a really good article that came out this week from GDS explaining like the impact of how many people don't run JavaScript when they look at GDS at gov.uk.
Right.
And if you think of it in terms of, like, their figure was like 1 in 93 people, yes, isn't running JavaScript. And if you think of it in terms of, if you make a tool that if government used it, it would disenfranchise 1 in 93 people from being able to access government information. Like, to me, that's a sort of like much stronger, I don't know, like, it brings the point home. Like, you can't, because a lot of people make the argument of like, I'll just, you know, do whatever satisfies 95% of the users. But there are some problems where like 95% isn't good enough. If you cut anyone out, like, government is an obvious example of that. But I think more generally, the effect of all these private businesses going keep the 95% happy is that there are a set of people who are just cut out from the marketplace entirely.
Yeah,
it's one of those sort of things of like, all of those businesses are making the right decisions in terms of their interests. It's too costly. It's not a good business decision for them to spend loads of money supporting whatever it is they need to do to make this possible. But the net effect of that is to, you know, cut a certain set of people out of being able to use any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I have like a great answer to that beyond, I don't know, smash capitalism, but
that'll do. Well, so it sounds like you have a fairly clear-cut idea of. So, for example, it sounds like you're weighing on the side of progressive enhancement, right? You would rather use a website that works without JavaScript, as you say, as Pete Hurley's blog post said. It's not just like neckbeards who have disabled JavaScript. Like,
yeah,
those aren't the only people you're talking about. And yeah, I think there's a tendency to imagine that those are the people you're, yeah, excluding. But
which
that's...
is then whenever I bring this up on Twitter, you get like, well, people say to me, oh, people shouldn't disable it. If they disable it, they deserve it. It's just like, okay, this is just people, you know, out who don't live in big cities who have terrible mobile reception.
Right.
Like, they just cannot use your website. I wouldn't say that's necessarily an argument. I mean, I do broadly support progressive enhancement, but it's not so much that I'm trying to make an argument against JavaScript per se. It's an argument about making stuff that takes too long to deliver to people.
Right.
Like, I was at .rb last week, and Steve Klabnik mentioned that there's sort of work underway to take stuff like Ember and make it be more part of the browser. So that, and if you do that, it means that sites have to download way less stuff in order to make the website work. And we're, you know, looking at frameworks like, you know, stuff like Hoodie that lets you send email from the client side. Like, that's
right,
a lot of, you've at least got to send all your templates, because you're putting no code on the server under that model. So all of your templating, all of your logic, absolutely everything that defines how your software works has to be sent to the user so it can be executed.
Yeah.
And it's not that that's... I'm not saying that's absolutely wrong. I'm saying that you have to keep in mind delivery times. And like, so, yeah, rather than it being a sort of anti-JavaScript argument, it's a kind of how can we change stuff so that we can make these nice fancy websites that are nice to use, but they're still like actually delivered quickly to people.
So you'd be quite happy in a world where those, you know, apps rather than sites, you know, we're using apps that are hosted on the web, and they are, you know, whether it's via, whether it's like Ember or Angular or whatever kind of, whatever strategy you use to do that stuff, you would fundamentally be happy with that as long as you, you know, as long as it works fine when you're on your mobile phone.
Yeah.
You're not fundamentally opposed to that model of the web. It's just that there are currently specific operational problems with it that need to be addressed.
Yeah, it's really a question about where the line gets drawn. There's currently a bunch of functionality that's baked into browsers that are expressed in HTML tags. We have HTML tags that say, make the browser do this. And all of the code that makes that happen is in the browser, and you don't need to download it.
Right.
But then anything above that, you need to send JavaScript to people. But if there are things that are being really commonly done in web apps that were baked into the browser, you know, so that they became effectively tags or, I don't know, like built-in JavaScript functions or whatever they are, that problem, which, like you say, it's not really a question of some people do have JavaScript disabled, and I, you know, like those people need to be catered for. But there is a much bigger chunk of the I'm not running JavaScript set of people, which is just the people don't receive all of your app's code.
Right.
So if what the app does can be expressed in a smaller amount of data,
right,
because more of it is baked into how browsers work, then that is a possible solution to that problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, the way things are today, that tends to come out of my mouth as being anti-JavaScript sentiment.
Right. And then maybe once that problem is solved, we can start addressing the problem of you not having received all of the website's fonts.
Well...
and so on.
Yeah.
So just to finish up... we've been talking for a long time now, but you're sort of talking about JavaScript quite a lot, and it seems like you have kind of I'm intrigued by the sort of love-hate relationship that you have with JavaScript, because on the one hand, your arguably most successful project is probably, well, so certainly on the client side, is all almost entirely used by JavaScript. I know there's a Ruby client for Faye,
right,
but surely 99% of people who are using it are running the JavaScript
for websites,
in browser, and then I would guess that probably the majority of those people are using Node on the server side if they're interested in WebSockets in the first place. So, like, you're a big deal to JavaScript programmers, and you do end up writing a lot of JavaScript, but at the same time, you do have this kind of moderate antipathy towards possibly not JavaScript itself, but some of the ways in which it's used and so on. But, you know, you're... So I know that right now you're writing a book about JavaScript testing.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about JavaScript testing. I'm not really a JavaScript programmer, although I do end up writing a lot of it. I'm not a proper JavaScript programmer like what you are.
I think there's a lot of people who identify that way.
Right. I have found it... this is not in any way a criticism of the JavaScript testing landscape, because I just haven't invested any effort. But it seems that, like, with Ruby, for example, there is... I don't want to say there's a broad consensus, because I know there isn't a broad consensus, but there are at least a couple of sizable camps of how you're supposed to do testing in Ruby.
Sure.
And all the only decision that you have to make, if you even want to make one, is just which of those camps to align yourself with, and then there's pretty much a golden path that you can just follow, and as long as you do what it says in the, I'll name no names, the X book and the Y book, then you're good, right? And it, as someone who is not inside the JavaScript community, it feels to me as though... that JavaScript hasn't quite reached that point yet. Like, it feels like there is a huge diversity of options in terms of how you're going to test your... Like, even in JS test, you've got this kind of laundry list of, like, here are all the places we support running your tests.
Yeah.
Like, you can run them in all these different browsers and all of these headless browsers, and you can run them in this kind of Mongo console and run them, you know, on VA or in Node or whatever. So, like, there's a lot of... I guess just by the nature of the language, it's much more widely distributed. It runs on many
more... It has a lot more users.
Right.
And therefore, there are a lot more tools get built for it. And it's... Yeah, I can certainly see what... If you're not someone who thinks of themselves as, like, quote-unquote, a real JavaScript programmer, which I think describes a huge amount of people doing professional web development, you're not... You know, your attention is not on what's happening in JavaScript land all the time. All of that stuff is sort of a bit of a grey blur and not very well defined. And it certainly was to me before I actually went and looked at all these test runners and how they actually worked and tried to integrate with them.
Right.
It's the frustrating thing about it to me is that it's like there are lots of tools that work just fine, but there's also quite a lot of sort of obfuscation. Like it's really easy, as in it's not much typing, to make to go and get Jasmine or Mocha or QUnit or whatever you want, one of the popular ones. Make a web page, put it on there, and write some tests and run them, and you've got a web page that runs your tests.
Right.
There is, however, I've sort of found this more in Ruby land, that it sort of gets obfuscated. So people make gems that say, okay, we're going to make a thing that lets you test your Sinatra app with Jasmine on Phantom. And they make a gem that like, ties those things together.
Right.
And that, to me, is sort of... it's not that that isn't a useful thing to do, but the way in which it's packaged is sort of obfuscatory.
Right.
Like, rather than going, okay, you've got some tests, like, I always start from the position of make a web page with some tests on it.
Right.
And then the second step is how do you make those run on Phantom, or how do you make them run on your web server? Mm-hmm. Like, it's the sort of... the same approach that I take to doing a lot of Ruby stuff is like make it work on its own, then make it work on Sinatra, then make it work on Rails, rather than taking all the Rails assumptions and baking them in at the start. And yeah, so because of these things tend to obfuscate stuff, they hide stuff like how does the test page get constructed? If you want to put markup in there, how do you do that?
Right.
Some things add in interfaces that let you load files off disk, and then that's means that you can't run that code in the browser because there's no way to do that in the browser. So you get coupled to that testing platform and you can't take those tests and run them somewhere else. And the thing is, there are a lot of useful places to run your tests. There are, various sort of CI servers, like TestSwarm, Buster, a whole class of things like that that will just sort of automatically run your tests in loads of browsers. If you don't start from the standpoint of just have a static web page that runs some tests, using those things becomes much harder. If you become reliant on server-side software,
right,
and booting a server process, integrating with those things becomes harder. If you're relying on a file system API that this thing somehow magically springs into life, that's not going to be available in this other ecosystem. So, it's not that like we've got enough tools. They're just like there isn't enough thought put into how they compose. There are some things that are presented so that you can't see how to compose them if you change your mind about something.
Right.
Because the thing is, there are a lot of these test runners have good APIs for, like, if you have a test framework, like Jasmine has a thing where you can write a reporter plugin that will just emit test results however you want, and you can use that to make it report the results to any of these test runner frameworks. Like, you can do that glue. It's just that there's a lot of projects that sort of go, okay, I've done the glue, but now I'm going to package all of it into this one blob.
Right.
And that means people can't really see how it works, so they find it confusing.
So in this book you're writing, are you writing this primarily to like evangelize a specific approach to doing JavaScript testing? Is that your goal, or are you just surveying the existing landscape? I mean, is this you kind of trying to convince the world, persuading through text rather than software, like making an argument that testing should be done in a particular way? Like, what are you hoping to synthesize by writing all of this stuff down?
I wouldn't say that the book is that, because the book isn't really about tools. The book is more about use cases. Like,
okay,
how do I test a node app that talks to a database? How do I test streams? Oh, okay. How do I test something that uses local storage?
All right.
It's sort of example-based, like partly because it's like you say, there are all these programmers that say, I'm not a JavaScript programmer, but they write loads of JavaScript.
Right.
Because they sort of have to. And it's primarily... supposed to be a sort of cookbook for those sorts of people.
Right.
I'm trying to beyond just here's how you set up the thing we're going to use for the book. I don't really go into this tool versus that tool versus, because I just like setting up tools is sort of it's sort of boring and not very instructive. It's just like, here's this arbitrary text you have to write to make this thing work. It doesn't go into, like, I want to focus much more on the principles of, like, you know, how do you apply things like assertions and stubs and mocks to these various problems? Like, what are the sort of timeless testing principles about how you construct code and tests, and how do you apply that stuff to JavaScript type problems? Because the tools are all documented. You can pick whatever tool you want. Like, they've got documentation. If you know how to do testing, you'll find picking up any of these tools pretty easy. I'd say in terms of, like, you know, code as argument, probably JS test is more, as in the test framework that I use.
Yeah. And wrote.
Right. That is more in that vein, as in it is a testing framework that doesn't try to hide things from you. It tries to, you know, the documentation explains to you how to integrate it with anything you want.
Right.
And it's designed to be able to do that. It's designed to just assume that you have a web page, and then if you have a web page, you can run it on Phantom. It's that sort of making minimal assumptions, not trying to create a big server-based framework, just going, basically, here's, like, treat it more as a library than a framework. Like, here's this thing, you run it like this. If you want to run it on this other platform, here's how you do that. Here's how you make it talk to some other stuff. So yeah, that's more of it, like, that, the way that is constructed is more in line of your sort of coder's argument,
right,
idea. Yeah, the book tries to stay away from tooling as much as possible.
But it's good that it sounds like you're kind of sneaking the coder's argument in, kind of under the radar as part of the cookbook. You'll also have to pick up all of these arguments will be absorbed by osmosis as you are doing.
Possibly.
This.
I mean, like, some of that stuff, like, it's something that I do tell to people when I'm teaching them how to do this stuff, is like, start with a web page.
Yeah.
Like, start with a thing you can just load in your browser, because, yeah, there are a lot of good tools for running this stuff, and the more your stuff is just based on static files,
mm-hmm.
the easier it is to do stuff like put it in your CI system,
right?
Without coupling to a lot of other complicated dependencies. So there are bits of that that are sort of, I think, are just general good advice that you can apply whatever tools you're using.
Right. Oh, that sounds great. When's the book going to be done? When you finish building a tool chain to generate like MOBI and EPUB files, presumably.
That's fine. I've said the other day, I don't have a book yet, but I have a really fun makefile I can sell you.
Well, that doesn't come as a massive surprise to me that you have ended up in that situation, but
it's fine. No, I'm it's like now, yeah. So since leaving Songkick last month, I've taken a bit of time off, gone on holiday, but now doing the book is my full time job for a bit.
Right.
So yeah, making steady progress. Hopefully out by the end of the year if I get my act together. But yeah, I'm sort of being at once discouraged by people who've written PhDs and tell me how hard writing is, and encouraged by people I know who've written books in a week.
Right.
And I'm somewhere in between those extremes is hopefully what's going to happen.
Cool. Well, good luck with it. I feel like I should let you get back to it, given that it is your full-time job now. But thanks very much for coming and talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.